Hello, this is Saturday, February 24th. I'm Jamie Grace Alexander, and I'm interviewing Rain. So I'm going to give it to you to introduce yourself as you would like to be known.
My name is Rain Alexander, no relation. Except that's not true, because we do have a relation. Yeah, it's since I met you in 2016, we often end up at the same events. And even though we're different in many ways, sometimes we get confused, like on the list, right? And they're like, Jamie Grace. And I'm like, no, I'm the other Alexander on the list. and I'm happy to be here in Jamie Grace's lovely apartment.
Do you remember one of the first times that we met?
Yes, clearly. I was going to, I went to UMBC to give a presentation on the project that I had up at the BMA. And it was in that little conference room where you can't bring anything in. You can't bring in any water or anything like that. And yeah, we were doing a little presentation about our project. And, you know, I assumed you were there with one of your classes or something along those lines, you know, because there were a bunch of people there. I remember you had a lot of really good questions. And, you know, I was like, okay, that one's one to watch for sure. I remember very clearly the first time I met you.
Wow, that's so interesting to hear, because your exhibition, Queer Interiors, at the VMA made such like a profound impact on me in 2016. I'm sure I've told you this before, but I feel like at that time I was like just getting started in the Baltimore scene, and I was living on campus at UMBC, and I didn't have a place to touch down after I got off the bus in Baltimore, except for Queer Interiors. So I definitely remember many times, like leaving school, maybe skipping class, and laying on that big bed and just like charging my phone and like scrolling, or just like taking a moment to recharge in that space. And that was really the beginning of my relationship with the BMA, because we started dating after that, me and the museum. I just felt like, I guess also the beginning of like my relationship with Baltimore too. So you're definitely part of my Baltimore story.
Well, that's really good to hear. And I, you know, I love that project was so well received for so many people. It was a hard project for me. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about it, because I could probably take up the rest of the day. But it was hard. And so, you know, when I hear stories like that, it really helps assuage the difficulty of it, you know, because it did what we intended it to do. Maybe I should say a little bit about what it was, since we're kind of talking around it. It was a year-long exhibition that me and a collaborator had proposed as part of kind of a competition with the BMA. And we won. I just, you know, quit my job and was like, I'm going to go off on freelance and try to like do some other art things. Applied for it, didn't expect to get it, but we got it. We got it. And, you know, we got some money to put this together. And the overall exhibit that this was talking about was Baltimore. Well, not Baltimore. It was talking about the BMA's domesticity collection. So like they were like pulling all the stuff out of their archive that had remotely to do with home. And so contributors to this project, they were proposing things like around domesticity. And what we did, me and James Mayhew, we proposed a project that was going to look at Baltimore's LGBTQIA+ community. And so there were three pieces that went in there. There was a cabinet, like a curio cabinet that we had created, where over the course of the year, different people would bring in meaningful things to them, you know, to their queerness. And so we met a bunch of different people through that process. James created this huge bed that I forget the measurements now, like, it was made up of these like 3-foot square maybe they were 4 feet tall, but like 3 foot square ottomans, basically. And you could separate them, and each one was topped with a different pride flag. And but you could bring them all together, and then there was a bedspread that went on top of it. And so that was the way it was mostly displayed, and visitors could come in and sit on it, which was great, you know. And we also did a what was called the I always come up with these like ridiculous names for things. The Baltimore LGBTQIA Home Movie Quilt, I think is what we called it. And queer people from Baltimore could contribute photos. And it was basically just like a live photo album that would change over time. You know, people would submit photos and then I'd do a new version of the video. So it was a quilt onto which we could project, you know, images. You know, a square screening area. And it basically just made this like huge photo album of Baltimore's LGBTQIA community, which was amazing.
You talking about this project makes me think about like your work and maybe my work too as a multidisciplinary artist and being a musician, being a activist, being a artist, and in some ways I feel like Baltimore is permeable enough that you can kind of dip your toe into these spaces, but in other ways people still want to pigeonhole you to the one thing that they know you as or the one creative expression that they know you as. So I guess, what has been like your strategy for breaking through that, getting people to take new forms of your art seriously, but also trusting yourself enough to try something new and put it out there?
Well, I'm going to ask you the same question. Sorry. Got that allergy dry throat thing going on, so I'm sorry about that. You know, as an artist, I moved to Baltimore to get away from political activism and social justice organizing because I decided I no longer had the temperament for it. I remember the last protest vigil that I organized in Santa Cruz was around Matthew Shepard's murder. And in the middle of that was like, I can't do this anymore. This work is too thankless. It doesn't, I have strengths elsewhere. And so when I moved to Baltimore, I was like, I can take all of my desires, my political desires, and channel them into art. And I'm going to do it through whatever means, by whatever means necessary, frankly. And so sometimes that meant music, and sometimes that meant visual art, and sometimes that meant, just getting up on stage and running my mouth, you know, stand-up comedy, if you want to call it that, you know. And, for a long time, I just had a policy of, like, whatever stage would have me, I would get on, because it was more important for me to be on stage and to be seen and be visible. Because, you know, during that time, and we were talking about the late 90s into the 2000s especially, you just didn't have the kind of visibility for trans people that we do now. And yes, I understand the critiques of visibility politics, but like, I was able to enact change through it. So, you know, and in some ways, like, you know, even later on down the line, I was managing the video store here in Baltimore, Video Maricon. And I realized in the course of doing that job, customer service for pretty much everybody in Baltimore, I was like, that is the most direct political action that I've ever done. Working retail, you know? which is its own kind of performance. So, you know, it's really a matter of like figuring out where I can get the most traction to deliver the message that I think is important at that moment. How about for you?
Ooh. I definitely relate to what you're saying about whatever place will have you. But I feel like partnerships is also a way that you get into spaces that you wouldn't normally. And I've used the model of like the Trojan horse for my art a lot. I remember when I was starting Gender Museum, that project was basically a vehicle to get trans people, trans art, and trans conversations into the art world, which I saw had like a lot of money, a lot of access, a lot of space that they were not readily giving to trans people. But when I saw that it was possible through Queer Interiors, I'm like, okay, give me the Walters, give me the BMA, give me Micah, you know, give me all these spaces, because I can. And I also think that this kind of relates back to ballroom culture, which is not something that I claim, but ballroom culture is kind of like, if you can look it, you can be it. And finding the confidence to like manifest that, what it would be like. And it is really just like the belief in yourself, like growing that belief in yourself, and then the doors fly open.
Yeah, I'd agree to some extent, but I also feel like that's a little bit slippery. You know, I mean, I have worked with a lot of organizations in this town, and the relationships don't always stay positive, you know? And I think for me in particular, just like looking back at a certain number of projects over my career, I think a lot of times people get a specific idea of what they think I am. And when I deliver something different, it gets bad. Right? And nothing specific is coming to mind that I really want to illustrate that with. But like, you know, I mean, I'm not a docile person, right? I mean, if I think you're full of shit, I'm going to find a way to deliver that information to you. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to be directly antagonistic. But I will get there eventually if you don't behave, right? You know, I mean, if your organization that is ignoring people complaining about your history of sexual abuse, right? And you don't address those issues directly and in public, I'm going to pull my support from you, you know, because at the end of the day, I am a radical feminist, right? I mean, I believe very much, you know, my core politic is body autonomy, right? I want to see the end of the patriarchy in my lifetime. You know, like I want these things. I don't expect that I'm going to see that realistically, but at the same time, that's one of the things that keeps me going, right? And that's why I make the work that I do. So, you know, it creates, you know, and I think I relate to the Trojan horse idea for sure. Like, you know, like I'll like, because the other side of it is that I've cultivated this like kind of wholesome, I mean, I think I've created this kind of like wholesome persona, right? You know, like my blonde Mormon girl, you know, life up until, you know, became radicalized, has really worked for me. Like I know these are markers of privilege, right? that I do have passing privilege, and I've always had passing privilege. But it means that I can get into places. And that was one of the first political realizations that I had way back in the late 80s, early 90s, where I was like, oh, I have these political beliefs, but I don't want to be a separatist. I don't want to go off in a commune and leave people behind. I want to stay in it. And I know that that means that I'll be compromising my politics. But, you know, I'm a change it from the inside person, ultimately, right? And I feel like I've been pretty successful in that overall, you know. Feel like I'm just speaking in generalities. I'm not really sure if I'm completely answering your question.
Well, one thing I heard you talk about was like tokenization and how projects can turn sour when people are not your fictionalization of what a trans woman is supposed to be like. I've definitely shared that experience. But yeah, I guess I was also relating a lot to what you were saying about changing things from the inside. And I feel like that path just comes with a completely different set of struggles. But yeah, I think that, oh, another thing that you said was about, I guess, like cancel culture or people who are just like not taking accountability. I definitely had that experience in the music scene, being a part of like a queer band. Like there would be like male bands who would ask to play with us, and we would have fans who would come up to us and be like, I don't feel comfortable coming to that show. And then we would drop out from the show. And not only would the man be mad at us, but all of his peripheral people would also be mad at us. And I feel like there are a lot of bridges that I was okay with burning, because it wouldn't have been fun anyways.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, you gotta know which bridges are fine to light on fire. And I'm not afraid to light a bridge on fire. And there's a lot of people in my life that have learned that the hard way, you know. And it's not just like, it's not always just people that are just like weird transphobes. Like sometimes it's other trans people that are just like, oh, well. And I'm like, look, I come from Mormons. I will cut you the fuck out of my life. They know how to do it, right? Like I'm really good at it, and I will never think about you again if that's what it comes to, you know. I don't like getting to that place, you know, at all. Because I do believe that change is possible for everybody. You got to be able to be willing to do it. And I think that, you know, in a situation like you're talking about, like, you know, the best revenge is just like living through it and continuing to be a band, continuing to perform. And they can stay mad, you know, as they like to say on Twitter, right? Die mad, right? It's not like I'm going anywhere, you know. I will stay here in Baltimore. And you know, if you're a person, an organization that is not going to be accountable, I don't have to support you, right? And I think that, you know, I think that there's plenty of people, like, and I feel like, you know, some of the things that have changed is that, you know, organizations and people within those organizations, like, I've watched them change, right? This is one of the benefits of staying in it and being the age that I am, is that, you know, I mean, I first fully came out of the closet in 1992. So I've been out a really long time. you know, went from a place where, you know, I thought that if I said the words that I'm trans, like the world would just like crack open and I would disappear into it. I mean, you know, my first full year out of the closet, when I went out on my own, like I was in a relationship and I broke up and I moved to Northern California by myself. At that same time, Brandon Tina was doing kind of a similar thing and got murdered, right? And so I remember that winter reading that story and feeling like so alone and so isolated, right? But like really feeling like that connection to that person that, you know, I never met and never would have met. But like, it just made me double down, you know, on like what my commitment was to just be out and like push through it, and realizing that me transitioning was, it could easily kill me, right? Like it could just easily kill me. And, but you know, I keep not dying, you know? And I keep building capacity. And I mean, even when I left Santa Cruz, so I moved from Santa Cruz to Baltimore in 2002. And around that time, I really spiraled out of control. I was doing a lot of drugs and drinking and, you know, whatever. I mean, and a lot of drugs for me is not even that many drugs, but it was a lot of drugs for me at the time. And, you know, really, really beginning to spiral. And it became like this binary decision, right? Am I going to kill myself or am I going to move to Baltimore? Kill myself, move to Baltimore. Kill myself, move to Baltimore. And like, you know, and I made the list, right? Pros and cons for each, right? And because I knew nobody in town. I knew one person in town. I could sleep on his couch. But, you know, it was like I could do a clean break, start over, see what happens. And, you know, and I took that gamble, and I'm so glad that I did, because it transformed everything. You know, Santa Cruz was not welcoming to me as a trans person at all. Even though, you know, I'd heard tales of it being a great lesbian mecca, it was not that. I mean, it was for some people, but it wasn't for me. And, you know, I mean, and I immediately found my people here, right? Which was great, you know? And I'm trying to capture like what it was that got me to this place. And so, you know, after being here for a minute, you know, and realizing like, oh, I had just like really narrowly escaped ending it all. But one of the reasons that kept coming up around ending it all was I already had done what I came here to do. Like, even as I was making my plans to move, like, that's when suddenly everybody came out of the fucking woodwork and was like, oh, you're leaving? I always wanted to hang out with you. I always saw you in the lesbian cafe and I thought you were so cool and so brave, and you gave me the courage to transition. Right? Like, let's hang out. And like, I made a rule, because I moved within 8 weeks. I made the decision to move, and then 8 weeks later I was gone. And I made a rule for myself, like, if you have not gone out of your way to hang out with me in the last year, I'm not hanging out with you. Like, if you were not around me when I was spiraling, when I really needed people, I'm not hanging out with you. Sorry. So a lot of people were like kind of finally coming out of the woodwork and being like, okay, well, you gave me the courage to do this. And like, this is such a nice thing to hear. But of course, you know, I was also like, well, why the fuck didn't you talk to me in 1994? Like, why did you like stonewall me? Right. And, you know, and I feel like, and I'd really be interested, because I want to ask you this. Like, I think that I have a very different relationship to the idea of what a trans community is because of it. But like, in the end, I was like, I've succeeded. If what I have been able to do is to help other people think that they can transition, my work is done. So if I end it now, I can, in a way, I can die happy. And then I didn't, and I ended up in Baltimore. And pretty much at that moment, I was like, everything that I do after this is kind of gravy, right? But, you know, ultimately, that feeling of contentiousness, even within, like, trans affinity, kind of remains with me. And, like, I kind of, you know, if you ask me in the right moment, like, I'll say things like, I don't really believe that there's such a thing as a trans community. Because I've never really seen it. Like, I've seen, like, I don't know if people talk about temporary autonomous zones anymore, but that was a huge thing that I was in the late 80s and early 90s. But mostly the person that put that idea forward was a garbage person. So I think a lot of people, like, let go of that idea. But, like, I feel like communities do function as these, like, temporary autonomous zones. They're good for a while, especially if you're organizing around a political principle, but then they kind of disperse and they dissipate. But it, in terms of, like, long-term community building, I've always felt on the outside of it. How do you feel about that?
This is such an interesting question, and it's what I was thinking about while you were talking in the first part of what you said about, like not all skin folk are kin folk. You were saying, like, sometimes there are trans people who can still have these same misconceptions of you, and that makes it all the more surprising because you were like, how could you think of me this way when I thought we shared this identity? And I think that I've been thinking a lot more about that space. I guess for me, like, the discernment to know when I'm being understood, and, like, the right questions to ask, that don't sound like the bitter girlfriend saying, like, do you like me? Like, I have to say it in a way that's like, how do you actually feel? Let's get to the truth. And I feel like something that's been really helpful in that is mediating. I was trained as a mediator this year, and I think that part of my enthusiasm to do that was because of these moments where we as queer people are mad at each other and it's based on not feeling understood by each other, or it's, which to me feels like an entirely surmountable problem. In fact, like, I think that it can be solved with art, you know? If you want people to be understood, maybe art is the vehicle to show people how you want to be seen or treated. But yeah, I think that there is no one trans community. There are trans communities. That said, like, queer people are my people. And I know when I am with my people. I just think that trans specifically is such an internal thing. Like the ASL sign for trans. Doing the ASL sign for trans audio description. But I think it's just like such an internal thing that it'll never mean the same thing just from one person to the next, like in a gender way. Everybody's journey to understanding themselves is based on like where they're coming from and where they're going to. That said, like, trans community is who I'm fighting for. But when I think trans community, I'm holding specific examples of like, these are the trans people who I love, the trans people who are in my immediate area, and they're the people who I get strength from when I'm fighting. But it's not like, and actually this is kind of a problem because when I get the victory, I can go back to those people, but the victory extends far beyond that to all the trans people, and there's no way for me to reach all of them except for with the victory, you know? Like, there's no way that we can all take a beat as all the trans people and be like, yay, we get gender affirming healthcare now. Like, we can't get together like that. I mean, like, we can, everybody can opt in, but I think it's like, I've also been fascinated with like the idea of forcing community and, part of what has been the most valuable thing about learning LGBT history in Baltimore is learning what positives came from things that people thought were a negative at the time. Like, this group stopped existing, and then if you follow the trail, that person didn't stop existing. That person didn't stop caring about the thing that they were doing with that important group. They probably continued to do it in a new way that they actually felt better about. Yeah. And if you track that, then you can say, oh, wow, this thing actually got the thing done that the first thing was going to do, that we were glorifying. So I think that those moments, for me as an activist, feel like a failure. When I'm like, my job is to bring everybody together and everybody's mad at each other and it's my responsibility to solve it. And how can I get the lesbians to agree with the gays and the transgenders and the non-binary? It's not, and this is what Ms. Monica tells me, is like, that is a feeling of ego. That is a feeling of ego and possessionness, possession over movement.
Sure.
You know, like, we need to realize that the work will go on after us, and the work was here before us.
Yeah.
And the work that we do is important, but if we put it down, it'll be okay.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I mean, you know, like, it's nice to, you know, get the recognition, to get the flowers, you know, all that stuff. But like, you know, as an artist, I can't spend any of my time just trying to get that recognition, you know, like, it's nice when I hear somebody give me positive feedback on work that I do, you know, that's always nice. But usually that's not why I'm doing the work, you know, and I tend to perceive things, you know, like I mean, and I think this cuts, you know, this is not necessarily always a positive thing. Like, I tend to ignore what people say and pay entirely attention to what they do, you know, because people say a lot of things that they don't mean or they don't understand, you know, so, you know, I'm thinking about a time when we went out on tour with my band, The Degenerates, and like, you know, we had a lot of experiences, some of them really great, some of them like really, really bad, because that's what tour is, yeah, as you know. But like my whole goal in touring, like through the South and the Midwest and the upper Midwest or whatever, Great Lakes region, was just to get up on stage and show people something they probably aren't seeing, a screaming transsexual, right? Who was open about it, writing stupid, catchy Buddy Holly songs about being gay, you know? And this was the MySpace days, right? So really pre-Facebook. And we played a show in Pittsburgh, and at the merch table, this like old couple came up, you know? I mean, they looked old to me. They were older than the core audience there. They really stood out. And they bought like kind of one of everything. And they were like, oh, we're here because our daughter is too young to be here, but she's a huge fan. And like, I didn't explore why, you know, is she trans? Is she like, I didn't ask, you know, like, because it's not really my business. You know, they didn't offer it and whatever. But somehow this like daughter had found out about us. And they're like, we just want to buy everything, and she's going to be so happy. You know, you want to sign all this stuff. And like, I think about that all the time. Like, I'm never going to meet this person. you know, I mean, this is so many years ago. This person is a full-grown adult. They could certainly find me on social media if they wanted to, you know, if it was meaningful to them. But it's not that meaningful. Like, that moment, like, that fuels me and carries me forever. And, like, it carries me through, like, any internal to Baltimore politics, you know? Like, you know, like... I mean, I often think about what I'm doing. I mean, you know, we're in conflict, right? Like, I don't love war analogies, but like, I do kind of think about that in these terms sometimes. Like, we're always like pushing forward. We're always trying to gain some ground, gain some territory. There's going to be collateral damage, you know, like things you have to walk off. You're going to get wounded. You know, like all of those things are part of what I'm engaged in, and like I'm committed to doing that. Like I'm always gonna keep pushing forward, so long as I think that something's possible, and you know, that a change can be made in that particular circumstance, right? And you know, I mean, whatever, it comes back to just like keep showing up, right? I mean, like, I know that that's kind of an ableist politic ultimately, but like, it's also just true. Like, if you're showing up, you're getting stuff done. And like, if you keep showing up, you're going to get responsibility. You're going to get access. You know, all of these things are very much part of it. And I will say that like in the last couple of years, as I'm starting to shift, like what I want to be doing, you know, in the wake of the pandemic hitting, my art project is shifting. My artist statement is shifting. And I don't yet know completely what it is. But like, I don't have to do, I'm not everybody's first tranny anymore. Right? Like, that was like my life for 25 years. And now that's not really the case. So now, like, what's my next act is really, you know, like, what's my next act is kind of the question. And I mean, you know, somebody like yourself that's like kind of come up through, like, I feel like the tail end of that culture, you know, like, I mean, I've said this for 10 years or so now, like, everybody's a tranny now, which is great, you know, but it also kind of keeps, you know, it makes it hard to like keep up and like, who's trans now? I don't know, like, whatever you're going to do, that's fine. But like, I would like it if you would actually give me some credit, you know, because I've been here this whole time. And, you know, yeah, you know, and I'm still struggling, you know, like I'm not struggling as much as I used to, because I had some things shift in the last year. But like, you know, economically, and you know, these kinds of things, like once I kind of retracted from the ways that I had been doing things, pulled my support for certain arts organizations, and stopped trying to do some things that were not healthy for me as an artist, as a human being, things have shifted, and I'm really interested to see where I go now. I mean, I'm in a period of transition right now, you know, and which is great, you know. I'm whatever, going into my crone phase. And I'll say this one more thing, and then I'll hand it back to you, because I'm just thinking about the ways that community is. A few years ago, some folks had started, you know, New York had this like trans ladies picnic for years and years and years and years. And like, I wasn't organizing shit like that, but I was like really stoked if somebody did, you know. Like, those years of that kind of organizing, I'm done with. And some folks did, some folks put it together. I was like, well, I've got opening in my schedule, I'll go that day. And I showed up, and it was, you know, just like a whole bunch of trans women, most of them much, much younger than me, you know, half my age or more. And, you know, so suddenly I was like, oh, this is a funny place to be. Like, yet again, I'm in a place with a bunch of trans women, and like, oh, what do we have to talk about? What do we have in common? Right. In the middle of that, like, it suddenly dawned on me, like, oh, I mean, nobody here is asking me to be a mentor at all, but like, one of the things that was always a challenge for me coming up is that, like, I didn't have mentors, really. I had weird transactional relationships with other trans women, older trans women. But I never really had, like, a trans woman friend throughout the 90s of, like, any, like, real substance, right? I kind of had one, but she died, you know, like, it was kind of like that. And, you know, because, like, the field was, I mean, everybody was in the closet. Anybody who was trans was in the closet. And, you know, the 90s was not that pleasant a place to be as a trans person, even in a place like Santa Cruz in California. But it kind of dawned on me in the middle of this trans ladies picnic, like, oh, you know, I can actually, like, I can just be a resource, and I can be, like, an older trans woman who's just here and, like, being nice and kind to younger trans women, you know, in a way that, like, was never the case when I was coming up, you know. And that moment of transformation was really, really, really good for me. And, you know, a couple of those folks are still friends now, you know, like, the picnic didn't last very long. But, like, I mean, I've always felt that intergenerational dialogue is so, so, so important. It was hugely important to my development in Santa Cruz, you know, because I was, like, connecting with older gay men a lot there. A couple of lesbians, but, you know, again, it was not the most welcoming place for me in the lesbian community there. Until it was, you know. But I mean, I feel like that dynamic has shifted, and I feel like that there's, like, peer mentorship happening in a way that didn't really exist for me at that point. Is that your experience?
Maybe I can share a different story from Trans Ladies Picnic. I also remember Trans Ladies Picnic, and I remember having that feeling of, like, okay, we are all trans, but what do we have to talk about? And I feel like most Trans Ladies Picnics, people would be talking about surgeries, like, this is the surgeon that I like, this is the surgery that I want to get, like, this is what they do when they give you the surgery. And it was really valuable to have that space. I feel like I did learn a lot when I was, like, little. But that was never why I was there. Like, I was there to, like, meet people and build community, like, to be known. And I definitely remember, like, just encouraging everyone to be gay. Or just, like, I was like, everybody take your shirts off. Wouldn't that be crazy?